capes, a bright even sky, or dark vast clouds, cut to my red heart, racing into town. Far ago and long away, maybe another century. Far ago and long away, a place that I have never been. Far ago and long away, a place that I have never been.
The end of the show. Just heard Ceramic Madonna Head. That is Linda Smith and Nancy Andrews, who have a new album out that came out in 1985 on this tape called War is the Health of the State, and the song is called Another Century. They have a new project out called Passing Cloud, started collaborating again, and they'll be on the show next week here on Radio Ravioli, so tune in. We also heard Lucretia Dalt with The Gardener, Cruel Diagonals, before that with Precipice off an album called Fractured Hole, which is new, out on Beacon Sound. And I think that is one woman from Los Angeles in Cruel Diagonals. That is, before that, we heard Shayna Cleveland with a song called Mayonnaise off an album called Manzanita. And I was just talking about mayo this weekend with Matt Warwick, and we were talking about how we didn't always love mayo, but now we really do. And it's unbelievable that we went so long in our lives of not liking mayonnaise. That's what I talk about at home. Before that, Bar Italia, a new single on Matador Records. It's called Nurse. And The Woods started the set off with Miracles Tonight. This is the end of the show. It's WFMU East Orange, WMFU Mount Hope in New York City in Rockland County, 91.9 FM, and online WFMU.org. Station manager Ken coming in just a second, filling in for Mark Hurst. So tune in. He's got Matt Taibbi on. Bye.
Welcome to Tectonic, a program about our shift to a digital future. Station manager Ken here filling in tonight for Mark Hurst, who will return next week. I'm going to introduce tonight's interview with journalist and author Matt Taibbi, and then I'm going to air it. It takes about 40 minutes, and then hopefully in the last 15 minutes of the hour tonight, we can take some phone calls about the interview or about the plight and the work of Matt Taibbi at 201-209-9368. So tonight, mostly, I'm going to be revisiting a topic from 3 months ago. I think it was January 2nd, the first show of the year, when I sat in with Mark and we discussed the Twitter files. In case you haven't heard about them, the Twitter files are 19 separate dumps of internal communications from the Twitter Corporation. Elon Musk, after purchasing Twitter, invited independent journalists Matt Taibbi, Barry Weiss, Michael Schellenberger, and a few others to have a look under Twitter's hood and then to report on it. Musk reportedly placed some conditions on the independent journalists who were invited to do this work, and one of the conditions was that they had to publish their findings on Twitter, at least initially. This they all did, which actually made it very difficult to read the reporting since they were all divided up into separate tweets. And then they all put it up on Substack as well, since Substack is currently where the more successful independent journalists reside. The internal Twitter communications that comprised the Twitter files, by the way, were not from Elon Musk's era. They were from the era of the people who had preceded Elon Musk, the people who had just fleeced him for $44 billion. And what the Twitter files show, I think, is a great deal of cooperation between the federal government and Twitter to manage the moderation policies of Twitter, to shadow ban people, to ban people, to de-amplify them, to the point that 40% of all government requests to Twitter were honored by Twitter. What Taibbi's reporting on the Twitter file show is that the FBI is the most active federal organization involved in moderating the content on Twitter. But it is not alone. It is simply the point organization. Matt Taibbi, since taking on the Twitter files, has taken on an enormous amount of criticism, especially from the left end of the spectrum. And I've been following the criticism of the Twitter files and the criticism of Taibbi as well, reading everything I can find on it. And I don't find anything that substantial in the criticism of Taibbi's reporting. When he has made mistakes, he's publicly corrected them immediately. When the Twitter files first started coming out last December, the party line that the left was using was that it was a big nothing burger. But I think, in fact, it has shown an enormous amount of information about government and social media collusion to manage the social media landscape. And we were not aware of this before. We may have suspected it. Some paranoid people may have alleged that this was going on, but in fact, the Twitter files uncovered proof of it. So I think it was far from the nothing burger that it was originally portrayed to be. Another bit of criticism is that Taibbi was doing Elon Musk's bidding, that Elon Musk had an agenda and was using Taibbi and Barry Weiss and company to further his own agenda. And what his agenda was, he clearly does have an agenda. There's no question about it in releasing the Twitter files. And what his agenda may have been is a matter of speculation. I personally think that it was simply revenge, pure and simple, on the people who preceded him, who just ripped him off for $44 billion. But ultimately, I don't really think it matters what Elon Musk's agenda was, because the information that he let out is kind of groundbreaking and lets us know things that we had never actually seen proof of before. And perhaps one of the other reasons that the left hates the Twitter files so much is because it shows leftist organizations in an extremely bad light. If you follow all of the 19 dumps of internal communications from the Twitter files, it shows some of the major institutions in a very bad light: MSNBC, the New York Times, even Twitter itself. They all come off very, very badly. The interview that I had recently with Matt Taibbi took place last Tuesday, April 4th, and since then, he had a very big week. He got ambushed on MSNBC last Thursday night on Mehdi Hassan's show, and Mehdi Hassan pointed out some errors in the Twitter files, which Matt promptly corrected. I think they were fairly minor corrections. And then on Friday, Matt Taibbi announced that he was leaving Twitter altogether. And the reason for this was between last Thursday night and last Friday morning, Elon Musk decided that Twitter was going to block amplification of any Substack content. So all the journalists who he invited to be his reporters for the Twitter files now find themselves unable to gather new subscribers or to get any kind of amplification of their content on Substack, because Twitter has, once again, out of revenge, blocked all Substack amplification on Twitter, probably because Substack had just announced a new product which was meant to compete with Twitter, a product called Notes. Okay, so I'm going to now air last Tuesday's interview with Matt Taibbi, and when this is over, hopefully we can take some phone calls. Here we go. Matt Taibbi, welcome back to WFMU.
Thanks for having me, Ken.
Listeners may remember the great program you did with Alex Perrine called The Tarfu Report. And Matt is also a legendary author and journalist in the grand tradition of H.L. Mencken, I.F. Stone, and Hunter S. Thompson. Can I say that?
Wow. Yeah, that's quite an introduction. Yeah. Thank you.
He wrote for many years for Rolling Stone magazine, and won the National Magazine Award for a series of articles on the 2008 financial meltdown. Author of many books, including Griftopia, Hate Incorporated, The Business Secrets of Drug Dealing. Is that your most recent?
I guess technically, yeah, it probably is, yes.
And that's a novel, am I right?
It's like a true story that we novelized, and I co-wrote it with an anonymous drug dealer.
Oh yeah, with an anonymous drug dealer. Oh, very cool.
Yeah, it is very cool, actually. That's my favorite book, believe it or not.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah, the ones that I've written. I think it's I really enjoyed that, writing that book, and it's really fun to read, I think.
I can't wait to read it. You recently set out on a new journalistic model on Substack, where you have Racket News. And you recently unveiled a great new podcast with novelist and critic Walter Kern called America This Week. Before Racket News, you were doing TK News, and one of my favorite things on there was Activism Uncensored. Are you still doing that?
Yeah, it's just been with the Twitter files stuff, which I'm sure you're going to get into. You know, everything has been kind of put on hold in the last... you know, 4 or 5 months to complete this project, which might be wrapping up. I'm not sure, but it's been very difficult to do anything else since then.
Yeah. Well, what was Activism Uncensored, or what are the videos are still up? So can you describe it for listeners?
And we're going to go back to that. And there's a videographer named Ford Fisher, who I ran into a couple of years ago. I did a piece about him for a series called Meet the Censored, which is about people who had been taken off the internet for various reasons. Ford is a very experienced shooter of protest footage, and he's a person who goes around the country, doesn't matter, you know, whether it's a left or a right based protest. He shoots the events, he interviews the people, and then he sells the footage often to big channels like CNN, NBC, etc. But what we do with his series is, rather than taking bits and pieces of the events, we just let him run the cameras longer and without a lot of editing. Selectively, you might see a few questions here and there, but the idea is to give people a kind of less edited look at what the various protest events are about and what they're saying, and try to deviate a little bit from the script of how we cover this stuff.
Yeah, it's really unusual to be able to watch a video of a protest by the New Black Panthers and not have it reduced to sound bites and actually hear them have a good discussion about why they're there and what they stand for. It's incredibly unusual to find something like that.
He has a good relationship also with a lot of these folks. He kind of knows the mechanics of protests. He's learned it over the years. And so he has a good rapport with people on both the left and the right. So yeah, the New Black Panthers or the Boogaloo Boys, and sometimes they get together. That's another thing that's interesting, is that he films these scenes where protesters of various stripes who you'd think of, you know, impossible to align, they do get together, and he films that and, you know, shows the interchanges. And I think it's really interesting stuff. You know, he's also a very skilled editor, so it's it feels like it's long. It feels like it's shorter than it is when you're watching this footage. It's really interesting.
Yeah, it is. So let's attack the Twitter files monster now. Do you have a thumbnail description for people who are brand new to it of what the Twitter files are?
Sure. So when Elon Musk, you know, the owner of Tesla and SpaceX, when he acquired Twitter, he, I guess, decided that in the interests of trying to restore some credibility and transparency to the platform for people who believed it had become politicized or, you know, whatever was going on, he decided he wanted to open up the internal communications of the company to the public. So he invited me and then subsequently some other independent journalists to come in and kind of just look through huge batches of files and write whatever we wanted to about them.
And these were internal Slack channels or emails or tweets, or what were these?
There were actually four different categories of documents. Their emails were one of them, Slacks were another. There's something called the PV2 viewer, which is it's sort of like a face page for what your Twitter account looks like internally to the company, and it's a bunch of stuff. Mostly it's emails, though. We found that emails are the most substantive and most had the biggest bang for the buck in terms of providing stories that we could write about. So, you know, we went in there. He very conspicuously didn't invite legacy media organizations in. And I wouldn't want to speculate as to his reasons, but I think it's been very interesting that he's done that.
They took it very, very personally, too, that they were not invited.
They did. And I think that was very conspicuous in the reaction to these stories. You know, the first one we did was about the decision internally at Twitter to hold the New York Post's Hunter Biden story. It was a joint decision, but it was really my idea to start with that because I thought, you know, the big question I wanted to answer was, does the FBI talk to these companies and give them recommendations about what to censor and what not to censor? And I thought this was, if it was going to be visible anywhere, this would be where we would see it. And as it turned out, in that first batch of files, we didn't see it. But there was some other interesting stuff there too. So,
how many Twitter files have been dropped now on Twitter?
I think overall it's 19 or 20. It's hard to say because we've had a couple of like little supplemental drops here and there. So if you probably counted them all, but separately it's 25, but there's like 19 big ones.
And how many of those were ones that you investigated and that you published?
Probably over half of them, mm-hmm. I would say. I think I probably did 10 and 11, 12, something along those lines. I have to go back and look.
I think I followed it closely up to maybe the 11th one, and then I have to admit that I then dropped off. So I guess most of my questions are going to be about the first half of the Twitter files. One thing that's really fascinating is that, of course, before Twitter files dropped, Twitter pre-Elon always denied that it engaged in what's called shadow banning, which is banning people without them even realizing that they've been banned. Now, you not only found that shadow banning does happen, but you found all sorts of internal documents that talked about how Twitter would moderate content. Can you talk about the various tools that you uncovered?
Sure. Technically, this is what we call the visibility filtering thread. This was actually the second big Twitter thread. And it was actually Barry Weiss's story, not mm-hmm. mine, although I worked on it with her a little bit. What happened was we asked some of the people at Twitter about shadow banning, and they just told us flat out that, yes, we do it. We call it visibility filtering. And then they took us kind of on a tour through all the tools, and they are incredibly elaborate. The company has the ability basically to dial your presence all the way down to zero, and then they can ramp it up as much as they want as well. The offensive tools or the amplification tools are actually a little bit more mysterious than the other ones, but they can certainly do things like, for instance, you can call up a page and it will have these little colored notations on it that will say things like trends blacklist or search blacklist. And that could mean anything from you can't be searched at all to you can only be searched by people who follow you to the people who follow you can't search you. I mean, there's probably 40 or 50 gradations, and we got pictures of them and put them up there.
Wow.
So that was sort of the end of that. There's no more discussion about whether or not they're shadow banning. There is absolutely shadow banning.
And then what else do they do besides shadow ban?
Well, the big thing that we found was in the first week or so, we started to see these emails that said things like flagged by the FBI or this is flagged by DHS. And then they would forward a whole Excel spreadsheet full of accounts. Now, at first, a lot of these were things that were, I think you would call obvious misinformation or disinformation, like telling people to vote the day after an election. But as things got complicated, progressed, we learned that there's actually a lot of content that they get into, especially with foreign countries. There is a very organized, elaborate bureaucracy involving not just Twitter, but really all the major tech companies. They meet regularly. They have a thing they call the industry meeting with the DHS and the FBI. They talk about different modes of communication. There's a standard setup for the FBI and the DHS to pass moderation requests to the company, which are then processed by the trust and safety people within Twitter. So this is we thought at most we were going to see a few emails here and there from the FBI saying, hey, don't do this, don't do that, or be advised of this. Instead, it's a regular, constant system that was so overwhelming that people were giving it within Twitter were sort of giving each other digital high fives when they got done processing FBI requests. So it's a pretty elaborate thing.
And it was the FBI, you mentioned the Department of Homeland Security, and it seemed like an endless batch of agencies.
Yes.
And that even went all the way down to local police departments.
Yes.
That could have a say, even went to, I believe, the National Football League.
The NFL they sit on the DHS advisory committee. So they sort of distantly have a role in all this.
Okay.
But the triumvirate of key agencies is the DHS, the FBI, and then the Office of the Director of National Intelligence, which is sort of represents the interests of all the intelligence agencies. Now, the structure they have is that DHS and CISA, which is the Cybersecurity Infrastructure and Security Agency, which is a sub-department of DHS, they take in all the requests from anybody within the 50 states, and that can be like the Secretary of State's office in the state of Connecticut. It can be a police department in Minneapolis. It can be the governor of California. It can be anywhere within the territorial of the United States. DHS processes those requests, forwards them to Twitter. If it's from anywhere else, from the federal government, it passes through what the FBI itself called the belly button of the FBI, of the U.S. government, which is the FBI, goes through a single teleporter port for Twitter, and they get requests from everyone, from HHS to CDC to CIA to NSA to to a whole range of federal agencies, and we're seeing all of it. So we published a whole bunch of those lists.
And from what you found, how long has this been going on?
So the formal system was set up concretely before the 2020 election.
Got it. And another amazing thing that you pointed out in the Twitter files is that they're not just going after large actors and large players. They're just going after like Joe Sixpack in some cases.
Yeah, that's actually the thing that I found most interesting is that they're not just going after significant accounts or what Twitter calls VITs or very important tweeters. There are a lot of requests involving people with 8 followers, 10 followers, 15 followers. In fact, there were conversations back and forth between senior Twitter executives saying, hey, this is hardly a gigantic foreign threat if the guy's only got 12 followers. They're actually saying stuff like that. So yeah, that's very interesting that it's done at a micro level. It's not just a macro level.
And one sense I got in following that particular Twitter file release, I think that went into all the government and corporate partnerships, was that it actually seemed like there was a real ad hoc nature to how it started. It actually did not seem like the federal government, came down from on high and organized it. It seemed to just kind of fall together. Is that accurate?
That's an accurate description.
Yeah.
Yeah. There was a lot of stuff that was deferred, and it's a very complicated narrative that really begins with Trump's election, and after that, the Senate Intelligence Committee, in particular. In tandem with the House Intelligence Committee, they approached Twitter and essentially demanded that Twitter open its doors to tighter content moderation procedures to obviate foreign threats. And this began a process by which there was communication back and forth between the companies and agencies like the FBI. At first, it was very halting, and the company put up resistance. And then by, I would say, 2019, it was really a formal partnership where it was hard to distinguish senior Twitter executives from, say, the top FBI agent in the San Francisco field office. They were basically colleagues at that point.
Yeah. And despite this, I think some of the criticism of the Twitter files that I've seen is that there's people on the left, I guess, rejecting the idea that this is government censorship. They make the argument that the government never really demanded Twitter to do these things, that Twitter did them willingly out of some kind of civic duty or something like that. Can you address that?
Yes, and what they're hanging their hats on there is a technicality. In all of these requests, no matter how many of them there are, there's in basically every one of them a little disclaimer that says, for your consideration only, for you to act at your sole discretion, we have forwarded these accounts which you may decide have violated your terms of service, et cetera, et cetera. So yes, technically they're not demanding it. They're not saying you have to take this down. It's kind of a wink, wink, nudge, nudge kind of a thing. And the downside for Twitter was made abundantly clear to them in 2017 that if they didn't open their doors to government, that there were going to be more congressional investigations, more negative press, and probably more regulation and taxation. And this stuff came out in emails that we found between Twitter executives talking about their discussions with the Senate Intel Committee, for instance. So it's, yes, technically, legally, it's up to Twitter whether or not they take this or that account down. But internally, they issued a guidance basically saying that outwardly, we're going to say that this is done at our sole discretion. Inwardly, if the government tells us that some this or that account is a foreign malign threat actor, if the U.S. intelligence community says that, they actually say that, if the U.S. intelligence community deems it, we are going to act. So it's, yeah, there's a technicality there, but I think if you look at it, from an objective point of view, it's pretty obvious what you're looking at.
So you had these, you had this consortium of agencies collaborating with Twitter to moderate content for all sorts of reasons, and they were also looking at, or trying to work with other sites as well, going all the way down to Pinterest.
Yeah, yeah, they have this thing called the industry meeting, and we found the minutes for these meetings, and there would be a mass email sent out to 50 or 60 destinations. It would include companies like the obvious ones like Facebook, Google, YouTube, Google/YouTube, Facebook/Instagram. But then there's also like Pinterest and Wikipedia and a whole long list of other smaller organizations. And they would go to these meetings, and what's fascinating about that is you would see the minutes, and you know, the first entry would be FBI briefing, and then the second one would be OGA briefing, and OGA stands for other government agencies, which is a euphemism for the CIA usually. So that I thought was fascinating. We just published that; you can infer from it what you will. But yeah, it's pretty intense. It's very organized, and It's incredible how far-reaching these communications are. There's nobody out of the cartel. That's what's so fascinating about it, and that's why when Musk bought Twitter, there was such an outcry, because essentially it meant that one of these players was pulling out, and that was the problem.
Right. Twitter pulling out.
At least partially from, you know, at least on some level, they were no longer like a full actor in this.
Right.
Like, I think they still, I don't know. I haven't looked at contemporary Twitter as much as I've looked at, you know, old Twitter. But I think a lot of the consternation was that they were no longer going to be the same kind of participant in these discussions that they were before.
And you, of course, found a great deal of paper trail of governmental agencies putting pressure on Twitter to moderate their content. Did you find that with other platforms? Did you find any evidence of other governmental agencies asking Google to moderate content or anything like that?
Yeah, we did. So for instance, we found a communication from an agency that we think is the CIA. It's not certain. We know it came through the Foreign Influence Task Force portal, which is technically administered by the FBI, but the report itself looks like it comes from the CIA, according to a bunch of CIA agents that I talked to. And it's a recommendation to YouTube that it take down a series of videos for quote-unquote anti-Ukraine attitudes. So some of the accounts you were still able to see what the videos were in the past. We found them. But that's a pretty, what's fascinating about that is that it wasn't an assertion of misinformation or disinformation. It was more an assertion that about the origins of the content. We think that this is content that came from the Russian government or is in sympathy with the Russian government. Therefore, you should take it down. So, yeah, we found a bunch of stuff like that.
Mm-hmm. Tell us about Hamilton 68, if you would.
Yeah, so Hamilton 68 was a crazy one. We found it sort of by accident. I was looking for something else and then suddenly stumbled on this big discussion within the company about a think tank called Hamilton 68, which is was created by a thing called the Alliance for Securing Democracy, which if you look on their board, it's got people like Bill Kristol, the former Homeland Security Chief Mike Chertoff is in there, John Podesta is in there, Mike Morrell, who's the former acting head of the CIA. They created this thing called the Hamilton 68 dashboard, which purported to track 600 accounts linked to quote-unquote Russian influence activities. And Twitter got suspicious of that dashboard because they were getting so many news stories that were saying, oh, look, Russian accounts are trying to hype up this or that hashtag, like hashtag fire McMaster or hashtag release the memo. Twitter didn't believe that their methodology was sound, so the trust and safety chief, Joel Roth, reverse engineered the list by looking at their data requests, and he found that it wasn't 600 Russian accounts. It was 600 accounts, most of which were sort of ordinary Americans, Canadians, and British who just happened to have views that may have coincided with some that some Russian attitudes or some attitudes that the Russians would have liked to have hyped as propaganda. And, you know, I contacted a lot of these people. They're just ordinary Americans. So Hamilton 68 was a source for hundreds of news stories in America over the course of the last 3 or 4 years. And it turned out all to be based on kind of a fraud.
Wow. And were there a lot of ordinary people on this list as well?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, there was the editor-in-chief of Consortium was on there, Joe Loria. So it's not just conservatives. There were a number of people who I would classify as kind of leftists on the list. There was a Stalin-supporting resident of Bulgaria on the list. There was a media organization, a smaller one called the Sirius Report. There were a whole bunch of people who I would say were like septuagenarian Trump supporters from places like Florida and Texas, who had small kind of low impact accounts with less than 5,000 followers. And I talked to these people on the phone. What they were doing is they were just making kind of an affinity analysis, like which accounts do these accounts follow or which news stories did they retweet? And that was how they determined which ones were quote unquote Russia aligned or not.
Oh, I see.
It was crazy. Yeah.
Now you lived in Russia for quite some time.
I did. Mm-hmm. 10 years, 11 years.
And I wanted to ask you about something that you mentioned on your podcast, with Walter Kern, which was you referred to old American propaganda that was put out by the Voice of America. It was put out by an agency called the U.S. Information Agency, and you were sort of contrasting what you used to hear when you lived in Russia on VOA as opposed to what you've been uncovering with the Twitter files. Could you speak to that?
Yeah, so Voice of America, when I first got, I studied in Russia when it was still the Soviet Union in 1989, 1990, and that's where I learned Russian. And, you know, Voice of America, Radio Liberty, Radio Free Europe, those were very popular among Russians back then. I think the appeal was pretty obvious to an ordinary Russian citizen. They would go outside and they would see things like, you know, you can't buy socks anywhere, or the price of sausage was four times what it was a month ago, and there'd be nothing in their local newspapers about it, but they could turn on Voice of America or Radio Liberty and actually get an explanation about what was going on in their own countries. And that was very, very important, I think, to the effort to win the Cold War, or at least win the hearts and minds of Russian citizens, and help pave the way for the end of the Soviet Union. But what they're doing now is the kind of successor agencies to USIA, which was shut down in the late 90s. They've now created something called the Global Engagement Center, which is very, very aggressive in its attempts to control information by means of censorship and these subterranean reports that it gives to companies like Twitter. But it does very, very little public-facing journalism or research. So it has a totally opposite philosophy as opposed to what it used to do, which is they would try to be open about what they were doing and make their arguments publicly. Yeah, so the old philosophy of USIA was that the U.S. government would respond to criticism by making a public argument. Now what they're trying to do is address those criticisms by censoring or de-amplifying them privately and quietly by appealing to companies like Twitter. It's sort of an opposite philosophy.
You've talked recently about the fact that even a little bit of sunlight coming onto all this stuff has caused some degree of embarrassment and backtracking. And there's been even some retitling of agencies. What's been going on with that?
So particularly within the Department of Homeland Security, if you remember last year, they announced the creation of something called the Disinformation Governance Board, which immediately struck a lot of people in this country as being Orwellian. There was a lot of consternation because the would-be head of that agency, Nina Jankowicz.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, she had sung this Mary Poppins song on Twitter, and she was a bit loopy.
Went viral, and it was just horrible.
Yeah, it was a disaster.
Yeah.
So they had to shut that down within 3 weeks. But they didn't actually end the idea. They just sort of moved it into this thing called the MDM Committee, which is the Misinformation, Disinformation, and Malinformation Committee. They gave it a new name. They assigned a lot of the same people to sit on that committee. But then they over the course of the last couple of months, it looks like they've shut that down. They've taken that committee off their website. And it's now unclear whether they've eliminated the idea entirely or they've just eliminated any public record of it. It's hard to say, but certainly it's interesting because the government so rarely makes any changes to anything. But this looks like an actual response to public discontent, which is, I think notable.
And of that MDM acronym, it's Misinformation, Disinformation, and Malinformation. Will you explain malinformation?
Yeah, malinformation is just a euphemism for something that's true but inconvenient. So we found this, I think we found a great example of this in the work of a group called the Virality Project, which was created by Stanford University. They were sort of a central processing operation that took in social media posts from 7 different platforms and helped them, gave them recommendations about what was or was not misinformation about COVID. Now, they sent Twitter an internal communication saying that you should consider as standard misinformation on your platform, even true stories of true vaccine side effects or true stories that may promote hesitancy. So in other words, a person gets the shot and dies. We want you to shut that down because we don't want you that people will circulate that and say the vaccine isn't safe. Or somebody gets myocarditis. We don't want that circulating, even though that happened, which is very, very dangerous. I understand the thought process behind it, but if you look under the surface of it, it's a direct strike at the whole idea of what journalism is about. So, yeah, I think that's very the whole concept of malinformation is extremely dangerous, I think.
So in the course of releasing the Twitter files and doing all this tremendous work that you've been doing, you were called to testify before Congress a couple of weeks ago. And how did that go?
It was surreal. I mean, look, I'll be honest. I'm a lifetime, let's put it, non-Republican. I've never voted for a Republican in my life. So
yeah, and you were a Bernie Sanders fan.
I still am. Yeah. You know? And so when I was contacted by Jim Jordan, who's the head of the Judiciary Committee in the House, and asked to testify about the Twitter files, you know, at first I hesitated, but, you know, not really, because like this interview, like any interview, I'm going to tell people what I found. And you know, if I don't know the answer to something, I'll just say that. But I thought it was important information. I thought it was important to try to tell the public about what we found. And especially since the conventional press hadn't really touched a lot of the material. So they had us testify, and I think it was a disaster for the Democrats, because rather than engage with the material or make an argument as to why people shouldn't look at it, they just really went after me and the other witness, Michael Schellenberger, on a personal level for the entire hearing. It was really bizarre. At the end of it, we were kind of shaking our heads.
They made you out like a serial killer or something.
It was like, crazy.
That you were like the most what did they say? The most dangerous man in America? Or I can't remember, some kind of hyperbole like that.
Yeah, the ranking member said that we were a direct threat. These witnesses are a direct threat to those who oppose them. You know, and that's scary stuff. I mean, I'm not going to lie to you. I'm normally pretty blasé about the whole idea of journalists taking risks. I mean, I've lived in countries where journalists get shot and that kind of thing. So I don't worry about it in America. That doesn't happen to us. But the government, you know, somebody from the government saying that you're a direct threat is a little unnerving. Then we find out that the FTC was investigating us. And so that whole hearing was a little bit freaky.
The Federal Trade Commission's investigating you?
Yeah, we found out that day. I think it was the day before, that the FTC had been sending letters to Twitter asking them about who was looking at the Twitter files, asking them to provide the names of any other journalists who might be working on that, on the story. Yeah, so they're asking about, the FTC was asking about which journalists were working on the story and, you know, who else besides me and Barry Weiss and Michael Schellenberger. And the reason that's a problem is because the relationship of a journalist and their sources, you know, has to be, we have to have the right to do that in private. Like, the government's not allowed to be asking about who's talking to whom. I think that's totally illegitimate, and it's kind of chill. There's a chilling effect there, right? Especially because if you're doing a story and you're talking to a source, you want to be able to guarantee them that your conversation is going to be private, that there's not going to be any consequence to that. And so for them to be asking about that, I thought was a little bit crazy, especially considering what happened afterwards.
And you found out about the FTC investigation the same day that you testified before Congress?
Yeah, it was either the day of or the day before, because Weaponization of Government subcommittee did a report, and they sent the report to us, and we saw the emails from the FTC to Twitter asking about the Twitter files reporters. So it was either the day of or the night before, something like that.
And wasn't that the exact same time that you had some IRS agents also show up at your door?
Yeah, so that was another crazy thing. I don't want to make too big of a deal about this, but I got home from Washington that night after testifying, and when I got home, I found out that an IRS agent had come to my house during the hearing and left a note on my door, a very strange note that told me to call, not right away, but in 4 days on Monday, so that I would have 4 days to think about whatever the problem was. So that actually did happen. And
and that would have been yesterday.
It would have been yesterday.
Did you call them on the appointed day?
When they told me to call in 4 days, I was like, screw that. I called them right away because I wanted to find out what the problem was. But they didn't get back to me until the following Monday. So then I found out that it was a very strange technicality having to do with My electronic returns had been rejected out of concerns for identity theft from 2018 and then last year. And I had never heard about the 2018 issue before. It had been electronically accepted.
Okay. Well, that's weird.
It was very weird. Yeah. Still, I thought it was probably nothing. I thought it was a coincidence. I don't owe them any money. As far as I knew, I don't have a problem at all. But then, you know, when I saw the thing about 2018, when I found out what it was about, I thought, well, that's a little weird. And I told the committee, I said, you know, I don't know what this is, but you should probably be aware that maybe there's some issue with your witnesses being looked at. And then they, you know, they made the decision to make it public, which has blown up far more than I thought it would. Let's put it that way.
Wow. We're talking to Matt Taibbi, journalist and author and architect of the Twitter Files. Matt, thanks so much for spending all this time with us today.
Oh, thank you, Ken.
And people can follow your new news agency, The Racket. Is it at taibbi.substack.com?
Yep, or racket.news is even easier.
Oh, great. Racket.news, which is great, as is your podcast, America This Week with Walter Kern.
A great author, very funny man. We spend a lot of time making sort of inside jokes that we think are funny, but I think the show ends up being kind of cool, I think.
No, it's a great listen every week. So thanks a lot for hanging out with us today, Matt.
Appreciate it, Ken. Thanks so much. Take care.
That was the interview I conducted with journalist and author Matt Taibbi. I talked to him last Tuesday, and then as he said at the end there, it was only after that interview last Tuesday that he had a very eventful week, and that after being visited at his home by the Internal Revenue Service and testifying before Congress. But after last Tuesday's interview, he had an extremely embarrassing, contentious interview on MSNBC, and then following that, irony of all ironies, Elon Musk decided to ban all Substack content from being able to receive any amplification on Twitter. This after Matt Taibbi and Barry Weiss and other Substack journalists did such a great job, I think, reporting the Twitter files, which, yes, had some errors in them, as some people on the chat board have pointed out. I myself am not a Twitter user, have not been a Twitter user since 2015, really. I didn't like the direction Twitter was taking even then, which is why I stopped. Yeah, no fan of Twitter, am I? No fan of Elon Musk by any stretch of the imagination. But I've been fascinated by the Twitter file story, not only because of the content that's coming through, and it's just a shame that it had to be published on Twitter. That's when Elon Musk, one of his demands, which made it very, very difficult to follow and to find. And the whole thing has been, it's been an amazing story, but incredibly difficult to follow it all, to the point that I only followed it, I think, for the first 11 or 12 installments, and there have been 19 installments. If you have any thoughts, and I know there's people out there with thoughts, I feel like I've been arguing on the chat board the entire time the interview was airing. So if anybody would like to call, the phone number is 201-209-9368. That's the phone number. We are live for the next 8 or 9 minutes. And then Dave Mandel comes in with the wonderful new prog rock show, It's Complicated. Because there's no time for prog rock like right now. And of course, the phones are dead. Definitely a lot of. And another aspect of the Twitter files that made it such an interesting story for me, besides seeing the real mechanics of how Twitter dealt with moderation, dealt with the issue of moderation, which was extremely dishonest. They don't simply ban you. Oh, no, no. They're way beyond. If they just banned you and said, hey, you broke our terms of service, you're banned, in my opinion, that would be okay. No, they do sort of this visibility filtering where they can dial you up. They can dial the power that you have on Twitter up. They can dial you down. They can label your tweet. There's all sorts of things. And this being discovered after they had denied that they did anything like this. All right. We have some people calling up ready to argue. I hope. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi. I knew I'd have to call in. Listen, just an overview of what's going on. Here I'm thinking, never before in the history of humanity or civilization have human beings had such opportunity to twiddle their thumbs. I say twiddle because it's like Twitter, tweeting, twiddling. Mm-hmm. People had to, you had to get to work. You had to plant crops. You had to get to work. You had to build things. And never has there been so much time for people to waste their time.
Yeah.
Anyone who was the preoccupation with Twitter, that kind of preoccupation would mean your death in the past. You know what I'm saying? Wolves will come. You know what I mean? There were too many dangers in the world. We have too much idle time.
I agree with that. And I agree with Mark Hurst's general thesis that time spent on social media is time wasted. So the extent of my social media use is actually the WFMU chat boards. That's the only thing I do like that.
Oh,
and,
yeah.
And email. I quit all social media around 2015, just in time. Well, thanks for your call. We only have
FTU
five.
FTU feels intimate. It really feels intimate, even though it's remote. There's something about a shared community and esprit de corps.
Yeah, well, I think it's nice that we have a small community. We're not going after growth at all costs or anything like that. I think that's part of having a successful online community is that it shouldn't get too big.
Yeah.
It can
reach across the ocean, but stay intimate.
If it gets too big, it becomes completely unmanageable. Well, anyway, thanks for your call.
Sure thing.
Okay, bye-bye. Phone number here is 201-209-9368. Just aired, I guess, what we might describe as a fairly controversial conversation with Matt Taibbi. I don't think there was anything controversial that we talked about, but I think just the very act of inviting Matt Taibbi on the air, on the radio station where he once had a show and where he's been a guest multiple times, just the act of inviting him on the air is controversial. Going to go to the phones. Hi, you're on the air.
Hey, Ian and Ken. Great interview with Matt there. Really
thanks.
Appreciate you.
Thanks. Matt. Who's this?
This is Zachary.
Oh, hey, Zach. How you doing?
Hey, doing well. How are you?
Good.
Hey, no, I think with all of it, especially with the recent interviews, it's obviously struck a chord, making the public aware of that kind of cooperation and coordination between the government. And I really see it as a red herring, talking about the free speech component. Where
oh yeah,
Twitter has every right to do whatever they want. They want to cooperate with any party. That,
oh yeah, Musk. I completely agree with you. I think Musk talking about free speech is a joke. It's quite clear that he's never even really thought about it, and he's never even really thought about issues surrounding moderation.
Right.
And there's.
Well, you talked about it too, moderating the WFMU community. I know the previous caller had mentioned something with that. You said you spend quite a bit of time, right?
Maybe, yeah, I do spend a lot of time moderating it. Yeah, and I definitely think it's better to just have terms of service that spell it out. I know nobody reads them, but I don't know what else to do. And then if somebody repeatedly breaks the terms of service, then you ban them, and then they're notified
right.
that they're banned. They're told that they're
right.
banned.
Classic internet. We were all on message boards and stuff in the 90s.
Right.
That's just how it was. You pissed the moderators off, and yeah, you got either temporarily banned or permabanned.
Yeah, and I think also that
another community.
I think that what we saw, you know, with the peek under the hood at Twitter with the Twitter files, I'm sure it goes on at every single large social media site. You know,
oh, it has to.
Yeah. So we're just seeing what happened at one, and we're only seeing what happened at Twitter during a certain period of time. I mean, it's really not, you know, it's just a peak, but it's the only peak we've ever really gotten at any of these mm-hmm. things, you know, and yet it's still being described as, that's a nothing burger, you know.
Right.
Really,
I think people will reflect back and they'll see the tremendous overreach in that regard. I mean, do we really want the government talking to media and saying, hey, we don't like you doing this. Please make it stop.
Right. Yeah. And I really like the comparison that Matt Taibbi made between the way propaganda used to be handled by the U.S. Mm-hmm. by the U.S. government with, for example, the Voice of America radio service,
right.
which aired American propaganda overseas. But it was very upfront. Like, here's the U.S. government view on this news story. And it's sort of, in many ways, it is kind of the opposite of what we're seeing now. Where any kind of divergent viewpoint is simply, you know, clamped down and just, you know, dishonestly throttled and disappeared.
Right. Yeah, if you can make people think they're still reaching people, while at the same time knowing no one's hearing them. You know, it's the same thing if you're engaged at civics at any level.
Yeah.
You know, anything. If you've ever been into a public meeting and read a journalist's report, like a small-town newspaper report of that meeting, sometimes they don't even cover the interesting topics.
Oh, yeah. I've read enough newspaper articles about WFMU to know to know how many mistakes, you know, how many mistakes are in every single newspaper article and every single online article, I'm sure, contains massive amounts of mistakes. Well, anyway, Zachary, thanks for calling.
Thanks, Ken. Appreciate.
Yeah, thanks. And I'm sorry to all the other people who called, who tried to call, who could not get on. But we are out of time. It is time for It's Complicated, our new prog rock show with Dave Mandel. This has been station manager Ken filling in for Mark Hurst on Tectonic. And Mark will return next week. Thanks for listening and hanging out, everybody.
Oh, and it's just about that time. You're tuned to listen and support of WFMU in East Orange, WMFU in Mount Hope, in New York City and Rockland County, 91.9 FM, and online at WFMU.org. Ken owes me because he forgot to do the legal ID. But you're tuned to It's Complicated. My name is Dave Mandel. I'm the host. I'm here every Monday between the hours of 7 and 8. Welcome. I just need to find my pen. We're going to start today's show with a couple tracks. First, we're going to hear something from Steve Howe. Steve Howe put out a solo record in 1975. Yes, the band Yes did what dozens of groups were doing at the time. Who else did this? Kiss did this. The Moody Blues did this. I'm trying to remember. I'm sure there are others. That is, members of the band's spoiled, pampered, rich rock stars decided to all put out solo albums. Every member of the band put out a solo album. And lots of bands, I think, did this at the time. One of those bands was Yes. So we're going to hear a track from the album that Steve Howe released at the time. It was called Beginnings. And again, I think I said it was released in 1975. Roger Dean cover. Roger Dean, of course, was the guy responsible for the most famous Yes albums, the sort of trippy art, and featured a few members of Yes, the Steve Howe album, that is, featured a few members of Yes. Bill Bruford, see if I can recollect. Bill Bruford, I believe, is on a few tracks in this album, the original drummer from Yes, of course. Patrick Moraz, who was the keyboard player. I think Alan White is on here, drummer from Yes. That's enough of that. So I'm going to play a track from that album, Steve Howe, Beginnings, and then I will segue into something completely different, namely a piece of Italian prog. I'm going to play something from a group called Banco del Mutuo Soccorso, which means Mutual Aid Bank, is what the translation of that band's name. And I'm going to play a track from that group from 1976, I think. And that group, whose name I'm not going to say again, I said it once, was one of the really big, one of the biggest. There were many, many Italian prog bands, and Prague was huge in Italy, but they were one of the biggest, I would say, and I believe still putting out records. Certainly, they were putting out records, you know, up till a few years ago, and maybe still today. So those are the two things we're going to hear to start off this evening's show, and then we'll be back. Thank you.